From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Chinese President Xi Jinping landed in the United States yesterday. His first stop, not Washington, but Seattle, where he's meeting with heads of many of the biggest businesses in America today. Apple, Amazon, GM, Boeing, Microsoft. He's already pledging to help fight cybercrime. But that's rich, given the flood of hacking that comes out of China. And that's just the top of a tough agenda on the table for the U.S. and China. Up next on Point, the big visit of Xi Jinping and the U.S. and China face-to-face. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where is this relationship trending? And what do you want to see hashed out with Xi Jinping in the United States? Join us anytime at On Point Radio or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Big speech last night. Henry Kissinger was there in Seattle. Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, strong Chinese leader, but in a time when China's economy and certainly stock market have been a bit wobbly, showing his familiarity with the world. He's made visits before here, Iowa, all the way back in the 80s and beyond. Joked that he went to Cuba and drank mojitos because he admired Ernest Hemingway, talked about China's current corruption crackdown, said it's not about power struggles or politics. He said it's genuine, and he made a playful reference here to American television, speaking through an interpreter.
In our vigorous campaign against corruption, we have punished both tigers and flies, corrupt officials irrespective of ranking, in response to our people's demand. This has nothing to do with power struggle. In this case, there's no house of cards.
No house of cards. This is not Washington and you guys and Kevin Spacey. This is my China. Joining me now from Seattle is Jeremy Page, reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Beijing Bureau. He's covering President Xi's American visit. Jeremy Page, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What is President Xi's agenda for this visit?
Well, for this first bit in Seattle, a very clear agenda is to send some reassuring messages to the U.S. business community, to reaffirm his commitment to continue with economic reforms, to continue opening up the Chinese market, and to reassure people that those stock market wobbles over the last few weeks are not a long-term problem. But there's also another agenda here, which is to try and sort of show leadership in the world of business, especially the tech world, to present China as a tech power and as a great market that these U.S. companies can't afford to ignore, and also to sort of highlight the positive aspects of the relationship, really as a counterpoint to some of those concerns that are being raised by the Obama administration.
He may want to soothe Americans. What's the message he's looking to send to his own population, Chinese, at home?
Well, the message back at home, it's always the same on these visits by Chinese leaders. It's to project an image of strength, to show that you're being given the respect that's due to a great world leader. So for him, it's very important to be seen back home rubbing shoulders with these world business leaders, but then more importantly, when he goes to Washington, D.C., to be shown being received at the White House with all the full honors that are afforded to a full state visit.
It's interesting, Jeremy. You wonder, I don't know about putting it this way, but you know, it's just whose side American companies are on. You at the Wall Street Journal, not you in particular, but this is a headline from the Journal saying China is looking for an unlikely ally, U.S. tech firms. China wants U.S. technology firms to, you know, ally with it. And then also in your paper, U.S. presses firms, tech firms among them, to raise China complaints. Washington wanting American tech companies to complain about their difficulties there. China wanting American tech companies to pressure Washington to lay off. What's the tough seat that these companies find themselves in, Jeremy?
Well, yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic, these meetings in Seattle, because, you know, cybersecurity in particular is one of the hot topics here, and as well as the restrictions, the problems that U.S. companies are facing more broadly in China. So one of the big questions is, you know, what do these companies say to President Xi? And as you noted, you know, we've got a story in the paper today saying the Obama administration wants them to speak up about some of the problems they're facing, because these companies often go to the Obama administration and say, look, you know, we're facing all these difficulties. Can you help us out? But, you know, keep our names out of it. And then White House officials, when they confront their Chinese counterparts, the Chinese government often says, well, we haven't heard any of these complaints from the U.S.
American
companies themselves. So, but at the same time, these U.S. companies are all desperate to get into the Chinese market because, you know, they're facing all these difficulties. So they, they in some way see this as an opportunity to improve their standing in China by showing Xi Jinping face. So there is a big question mark over, you know, the extent to which they will voice those concerns in these meetings. They're not all going to be public. There are sort of certain sections which are open to the media. So the big question is what goes on behind closed doors.
Big meeting of the Paulson Institute today in Seattle with super tip-top American business leaders there. Tim Cook from Apple is there. Jeff Bezos, Amazon, top Microsoft CEO Mary Barra, CEO of General Motors, and right on down, Walt Disney, DuPont, Dow, Pepsi, Boeing, IBM, Starbucks. Are they going to really rattle his cage? I mean, after all, Apple, what, not long ago, they did 2% of their business in China. Now it's 25% of their business.
Right. Well, as I said, that's the big question. I mean, the suspicion, I think, within the broader business community is that they're not going to deliver a particularly strong message. I think it's going to be more couched in positive terms, along the lines of, you know, we are committed to the Chinese market. We would like to help with your reform agenda. We believe that the private sector, Chinese and American, can play a key role in helping you to achieve your aims in sort of restructuring the Chinese economy and breaking apart some of those vested interests that Xi Jinping often refers to in his speeches. And, you know, there might be some allusions to some of the problems that these companies are facing. But, I, you know, judging by, you know, what normally happens in these kind of meetings, corporate leaders and Chinese leaders, they don't see it as an opportunity to really confront. It's more sort of, you know, an exercise in diplomacy. And there are, as you say, you know, there's some big names there, big companies. They have a lot at stake in China.
The stakes are very high on both sides. A lot of tea leaves will be read. And when it's over, there will be one direction or another. Jeremy Ma, Page, is covering Xi Jinping's visit to the U.S. out of the Beijing Bureau of Wall Street Journal. He's in Seattle. Jeremy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
President Obama, talking at the Business Roundtable in Washington just a week ago, sort of speaking directly to China on a really hot issue, Chinese hacking. Hacking into the U.S. government computers, hacking into American business computers. A lot of intellectual property has been lost there. The president was pretty tough. Here he is.
Your government or its proxies engaging directly in industrial espionage and stealing trade secrets, stealing proprietary information from companies. That we consider an act of aggression that has to stop.
That is about as blunt as you can get. Here was China's President Xi Jinping last night in Seattle saying, let's work on this. We'll work with you.
China is a staunch defender of cybersecurity and also a victim of hacking. We will not engage in commercial theft or encourage it. Cyber theft and hacking crimes must be punished in accordance with law and the national treaties. The international community should, on the basis of mutual respect and trust, work together to build a peaceful, safe, open, and a cooperative internet space. China is willing to set up a high-level joint dialogue mechanism with the United States on fighting cyber crimes.
With us right now from San Diego, Susan Shirk at University of California, San Diego, School of Global Policy and Strategy there, author of China and Changing Media. Susan Shirk, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And from Chicago, Damian Ma joins us, fellow at the Paulson Institute at the University of Chicago. The Paulson Institute, this is Hank Paulson, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, very involved in U.S.-China relations, sponsoring hosting the meeting there today in Seattle. Damian Ma, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
When the Chinese president says we are a staunch defender of cybersecurity, is that laughable?
Are you asking Damian?
I'm asking you, Damian. Is it your...
No, I don't think it's laughable. I think the rhetoric has certainly been ratcheted up from the White House.
Rhetoric? I thought we had real attacks on the American government computers and on lots and lots and lots of American corporate computers.
Right.
From China.
I think... I think the key issue is, you know, there are two separate things. There's the traditional espionage type of national security issues, and then there is the intellectual property theft, which that was the clip he played from President on Obama.
The president says he's okay with espionage. I mean, that's interesting in itself. But he said the rest is an act of aggression, stealing trade secrets, industrial espionage. The president of the United States is saying you're engaged in this, and it has to stop. It's an act of aggression. Is China credible when it says, we're a defender of cybersecurity?
Well, this is a very challenging issue in general. It's, you know, the context of it is basically having to do with intellectual property. And, of course, in our information modern technology age, it's made it just easier, as things become digital, things are in the cloud, it's become pretty easy to
kind of— We all get that. It sounds like you're dodging. The president is openly calling it stealing trade secrets and industrial espionage. Is the Chinese president credible when he says that they're a staunch defender against that?
It's very hard to say. I am not a cybersecurity expert, so I can't say whether, you know, who's right or who's wrong. But I do know that both countries really ought to come together and find some rules of the road. And I think that's really the hope from the White House, to really establish some rules of the road so that there are some limitations and boundaries to what can be done and what is totally off limits.
Susan Shirk, there's a broader agenda here, and we will look at it. But given that the president and many others have said there's a lot of this hacking going on, and it's gone right to the heart of the government and to big American corporations, how do you see the Chinese president's assertion that China is ready to work with the U.S. on this?
Well, I think it's essential and somewhat encouraging that he understood at least how serious the concern is. He heard what President Obama said. I mean, President Obama made a threat of sanctions, and there was a lot of discussion about possibly imposing those sanctions before the summit, which could have led to a cancellation of the summit. So the U.S. side, before this meeting, was showing very strong resolve here by showing willingness to take actions that would have been costly to us as well as to China.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to America and the tough issues on the table with the USA. The Chinese president into Seattle last night, today, meeting with Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook of Apple, with Mary Barra, CEO of General Motors, and a whole lot more tip-top American CEOs, also leaders of top Chinese corporations who sitting down there as well in Seattle. He will fly on. He'll visit an American high school in Tacoma. He's got an agenda right across the country, but heads into Washington where there's some tough stuff on the table. Susan Shirk is with us from San Diego at the University of California, San Diego, School of Global Policy and Strategy. Damian Ma is with us from the University of Chicago and the Paulson Institute. Hank Paulson, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, founded that. Of course, he's hosting this meeting of Xi Jinping and business leaders in Seattle today. Xi Jinping flew in, talked in Seattle last night, made jokes about sleepless in Seattle. I guess he may have felt that way. Chinese stock market been in trouble lately. Chinese government trying to prop it up. Same time, he's been pushing for reforms, market-oriented reforms. He talked some about that last night through an interpreter.
When it comes to the toughest reforms, only those with courage will carry the day. We have the resolve and the guts to press ahead and take reform forward. We will stick to the direction of market economy reform and continue to introduce bold and result-oriented reform measures concerning the market, taxation, finance, investment and financing, pricing, opening up, and people's livelihood.
Damian Ma, when the businessmen assembled there in Seattle today are listening to Xi Jinping talk about the Chinese economy, what are they most concerned about? We've heard a lot lately about the difficulties of doing business in China, even about questions about China's commitment to market economics with the very large government intervention we've seen recently. Of course, America has had its own interventions back in the financial crisis. What do you think will be foremost on those American business leaders' minds as they listen to Xi Jinping, Damian?
Well, first of all, I think President Xi did a pretty good job last night sending the message of doubling down on essentially reform and opening up. And it's important to include the latter part of opening up, because I think one of the underlying worries was that China was going to reform but not necessarily opening up, meaning more market access. So that would be a bit of a change from what Deng Xiaoping launched in 1978, which was reform and opening up, meaning liberalization. So that was the underlying big concern, and I think President Xi did send that message. I think the other two big issues are regulatory barriers and also domestic competition, meaning specifically with state-owned enterprises, which are really the sort of the vested political interests that is being constantly talked about. They're extremely powerful, and they're also
in China. And you're talking largely party-related powers there. The Chinese government, i.e., party, is deep in business, state business.
That's right. The party does control all those state assets, especially the 113-ish central state-owned enterprises. They're huge. Just to give you one example, the biggest oil company, PetroChina, has more than 1 million people on its payroll. So they're gargantuan size, and they pose competitive challenges to U.S. firms.
Susan, there's been a lot of talk that as the Chinese economy has wobbled and cooled, President Xi, who's quite a strong figure, strongest president there in a long time is what he projects, has been talking more nationalistically. Do you see that? And if so, why?
Well, President Xi has an interest in enhancing his own domestic popularity, and there's nothing like an external threat to help a leader do that. I mean, he's not the only one. We see leaders in Japan and Korea kind of doing the same thing as well.
And not to mention Donald Trump, maybe, and a few others at home.
But there's no indication right now, objectively, that his domestic popularity has declined. But we can assume that he's constantly worried about that. A leader like Xi, who has consolidated power in his own hands more than any leader since Deng Xiaoping or even maybe Mao Zedong, has to always worry about a backlash from other parts of the political elite, the party elite, and has to worry about a backlash from the public. And as growth declines, and most people believe that Chinese economic growth is actually far below the 7% that they've been claiming, he has to worry that people are going to feel discontented, people may lose their jobs, and if he can distract them with a good fight, and I don't necessarily mean a real fight, but tension and conflict over China's territorial claims in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, then, that works for him.
Where do you see, I want to look more at the cyber issue, but Susan, where do you see this relationship trending overall?
I think it's become much more competitive than it was when I served in government in the Clinton administration from 97 to 2000.
You were Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, U.S.
Right.
Policy toward China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, all that.
Right. Here's the way it feels to me when I go to Washington, is that nowadays when China behaves poorly, aggressively toward its neighbors or even toward its own people, to the extent that triggers a reaction from other countries who want to get closer to the United States, people in the State Department and in other parts of our government sort of seem to gloat, score one for our side. And I have a feeling that in Beijing, they're doing the same when the United States stumbles. So,
kind of a dangerous game.
Yeah, it's like it's a big contest. And that's not the attitude we had in the end of the 90s. At that time, we were really rooting for China to do the right thing and for us to figure out a way to cooperate with one another. Now, I'm not saying that President Obama and the people who work for him don't want that too, but I think the misperceptions on both sides and at the public level and at the business level, as we've just been talking, are that this is much more a contest for supremacy, global supremacy. between these two major powers.
Of course. I mean, back in the 90s, China had an economy the size of Italy's. Now, by some measures, it's number one in the world. That's a pretty big change.
True. And that may be, you know, international relations experts would explain the whole thing that way.
Damien, what do you think the United States is going to push hardest on here? I mean, if we can look at the territorial piece for a moment, China claims a lot of the South China Sea. The neighbors of that sea, Vietnam, Philippines, Indonesia, others say, wait a minute, the Philippines now may be inviting the U.S. to come back to the once naval base in Subic Bay. It was a huge American naval base. They kicked us out. Maybe they want us back because China is muscling up there in the South China Sea. How do you see the territorial issue playing?
Well, that again is one of the most contentious issues on the table. I don't really see that, you know, a state visit by the Chinese president is going to, you know, seriously solve the underlying issues there. The best we can hope for is to again come up with some rules of the road to kind of set limits and boundaries. But I think, you know, the key in terms of seeing some progress, I would say that you know, most people are looking at making more significant progress on the bilateral investment treaty, which has a pretty significant economic rationale to kind of rebolster the economic relationship. And I think another pretty positive silver lining is probably going to be on climate change and clean energy, where I think that the countries do have an alignment of interests.
I want to come back to the issue of the cyber threat. There's been so much going on there. It's kind of incredible, and the American president talking very openly about it. Xi Jinping was here in 2013. It wasn't a state visit, but a more casual visit with President Obama, and he talked then about confronting cyber attacks, asserted then as well that China also was a victim of hacking.
By conducting good faith cooperation, we can remove misgivings and make information security and cybersecurity a positive area of cooperation between China and the U.S. Because China and the United States both have a need and both share a concern. And China is a victim of cyber attacks. And we hope that earnest measures can be taken to resolve this matter.
Xi Jinping, 2013, in the United States. How has that worked out? Not so well, I guess. We've all seen the big headlines. And here again, just last week, here's President Obama with a pretty strong message for China.
This is not just a matter of us being mildly upset, but is something that will put significant strains on the bilateral relationship if not resolved, and that we are prepared to take some countervailing actions.
Countervailing actions. Now, this starts to get really interesting. Susan Shirk, please stand by in San Diego. Damien Ma in Chicago. With me in the studio right now is August Cole, resident at the Atlantic Council, looks at national security, future of war, co-author with Peter Singer of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war, which imagines a cyber war scenario. August Cole, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here in the studio.
So, very happily, as far as I can see, we're not talking cyber war here, though they're talking about cybersecurity that extends into that realm potentially. Do you see any breakthroughs here on the hacking front? Let's just start there. You know, what is it they say? If you everybody's been hacked into. If you don't think you have, you just don't know.
Hacking is going to continue between the U.S. and China. It's sort of like the espionage that we conducted against the Soviets during the Cold War.
I don't really get that. So I mean, that was about where are the troops?
What I was going to add to that to say is that with this, though, there's a commercial component now, so that the act of stealing information is no longer just about battle plans or technologies around a new missile. It's in fact about algorithms that drive search engines or intellectual property around telecommunications switching gear. So suddenly the arena is far bigger than it ever has been, and the technology to do so, as one of the guests was saying, is even more effective. I think putting this in the context too, that cyber espionage has a military component too that makes this much more delicate than just the conventional business community approach to it, which sees it as a IP question, which of course is significant too. But there's a lot more there.
I mean, it's also complicated by the fact that you've got the Chinese government and then a lot of state-owned corporations. So when hacking happens, if it is for intellectual property, it can and does benefit companies that this government owns.
So there's a parallel in the military development that China is going through right now. Their latest stealth fighters are effective copies, like kissing cousins of the latest U.S. planes that we've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, in certain cases. And that is clearly from steady IP theft in the defense sector. So is that a business question for a company like Lockheed Martin? Yes. But for the Pentagon, it's also a national security issue.
So there's talk about a deal to work on a deal that says, well, okay, it would be in a way the first cyber war treaty. We won't go after each other's critical infrastructure has been talked about. Do you see that emerging? Is it possible that they'll come to some understanding about a deal on that? And how much territory would really get fenced by that deal, given the very wide spectrum of interaction we're talking about here?
I think an actual treaty will be very difficult to execute. I think an understanding, as you said, may have more hope, particularly around, let's say, nuclear facilities, special parts of the Pentagon's communications infrastructure, like controlling nuclear launch. What we don't want...
So we won't look into yours and you won't look into ours when it comes right down. Aren't they also talking, is it broader infrastructure, power plants and so on?
So power is one of the main targets right now of a lot of the Chinese state hacking. Third Army of the PLA has already been indicted by the Justice Department and some of its members for hacking steel infrastructure, energy infrastructure. So we know they're targeting that, and that's probably going to continue. So I think it's thinking about the things that, if hacked, could create the perception of war starting is what we really want to fence off so that we don't have an inadvertent escalation from cyber war to real war.
Susan Shirk, we clearly don't want to get into that, but well shy of that, there's been this very big, steady bleed of American intellectual property to China, and the president explicitly last week calling that an act of aggression. How does that get addressed here? Xi Jinping says we want to fight it. We want to fight cybercrime. How does that get acted on?
Well, first of all, the first step was for him to make the public pledge again, which he did in Seattle. The second step is what he says to President Obama privately. And my understanding is that President Obama has been very frustrated, and you can almost hear it in his voice
when
he talks about this issue, because he did share information with President Xi back at that 2013 Sunnylands meeting and thought he had gotten a promise from Xi Jinping to look into it and do something about it. But in fact, this cyber theft from our companies has only increased. So that's why he's making threats of sanctions and showing that he would have even been willing to have the visit be canceled by the Chinese side because he feels so strongly about it. Now, President Xi certainly could make that kind of theft of intellectual property through cyber hacking illegal and pledge to stop it in China. But he could enforce that. He has every ability over the security apparatus, over the military, to stop it if he wants. The problem is we don't really know what Xi Jinping wants. And increasingly, we believe that he wants to build up China's capabilities at the expense of the United States. And he's willing to accept more friction, more tension in the relationship with the United States to get there.
Damian Maad, if that's the do you have any indicators of whether that's his real agenda? He's willing to take the heat to keep on taking the goods?
I have no indication whether he's more willing to do to take the heat, as you put it, on this specific issue. But I do agree with Susan that I think he does appear to be more risk tolerant as a president, and he's conducting foreign policy in a way that we haven't seen in quite some time. So he believes that he can basically manage domestic economic reforms and conduct a more assertive, robust foreign policy at the same time. Now, there are questions whether that's actually possible, given the huge domestic challenges he has on the table. So there's a bit of a contradiction there, but I think looking at what he's done so far, he's willing to try to do it on both ends, domestic and foreign policy.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit to America and the tough issues on the table with the USA, with Damian Ma. He is a fellow at the Paulson Institute, University of Chicago. Susan Shirk, University of California, San Diego, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, responsible for U.S. China policy. August Cole is with me in the studio, a co-author of Ghost Fleet, is at the Atlantic Council. It's a novel, but it looks at what a cyber war would look like, imagines it. Response online here, Sombra says, I just hope we take a positive direction with China and do not alienate them by continuing to make them the other. Amen. And we've got huge mutual interests here, and the world kind of counts on these countries getting along. How's that going to work? Jill says, we're in no position to play hardball with anyone. We're not on high ground here. We should pay attention to what we're doing before we go wagging our fingers at others. Okay, but how much hacking, you know, do you just want to take? Richard in Asheville, North Carolina, thank you for calling, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. That last point is the one I really want to talk about, and that is, I think it can be argued that we're probably the ones that let this genie out of the bottle, and all of the big powers are playing this game. What concerns me is that because of the openness of our society, comparative openness compared with China, we are at a disadvantage when we have the Edward Snowdens of the nation and others who are restricting the secrecy that we or impeding the secrecy that
breaking it, yeah,
carried out with.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts us at a significant disadvantage as we go forward, because we're not going to escape from the need to compete at the cyber level, if that's the right way of putting it.
I mean, I take your point fully, though. Beyond WikiLeaks, China can just come in. They don't need Edward Snowden for many things, just to come and get it and have. Susan, have you looked at what an agreement might look like if the shape of one begins to form here, even if it's limited in the beginning on some boundaries around cyber insults?
I have only read what's in the media about the discussions between the U.S. and Chinese side. I mean, actually, I have spoken to some Chinese experts who have been part of Track 2 discussions on this subject, and I think, yes, it'll start by taking some of the most extreme cases, as August said, about hacking into important security
nuclear facilities,
installations,
let's say.
Yeah, and start to work that way. And I think, I mean, it is a great thing to get started with any agreement because, of course, remember the days when there were no agreements on nuclear weapons. We have a new capability here, and the nations of the world are struggling to find ways of preventing it from being very destabilizing. So, and it'll demonstrate that the U.S. and China can work together on a very tough issue, but it's not going to solve the problems of our companies who feel that their intellectual property is being stolen by China. And I'd like to just highlight one issue about intellectual property.
Yes,
in China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, President Xi Jinping referred to House of Cards in his speech last night, which was a very clever way of showing that he's aware of what's going on in Western culture and
yes,
even has a taste for it himself. But
or one of his minions in Washington likes to watch Kevin Spacey,
yeah,
and Kerry Washington. I don't know.
No, but actually, a Chinese company bought House of Cards to show on Chinese video online.
So they can see how corrupt American government is?
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, people learned quite a lot about American politics
mm-hmm.
from watching it. But here's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The censors, the regulators in China, my understanding is that they've basically censored the current
season. Mm-hmm. Why?
House of Cards, even though I understand it deals with Russia, not China. And so And, of course, what that means is that people have to go online and buy the pirated versions. So the even House of Cards is wrapped up in the censorship and intellectual property issues.
Controversy even there. Jeff writes to us online, China, please respect our intellectual property laws. That's the main issue. We are in new territory here. President Obama talked about it when he was with Xi Jinping back in 2013, saying, you know, we're looking to negotiate what's acceptable and what's not.
In some ways, these are uncharted waters, and you don't have the kinds of protocols that have governed military issues, for example, and arms issues, where nations have a lot of experience in trying to negotiate what's acceptable and what's not.
Get a call from Lexington, Kentucky. Aaron, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, from what I've seen from Xi Jinping before, it seems like that he's held his card so close to his chest, they've been practically behind his ribcage. So if, you know, if communist officials had known that he was going to do the corruption crackdown before, you know, he was named president, then he would have never been named president. So I don't, if his own members of the Communist Party can't trust what he's saying, and he can be that charismatic, get to that point, and then turn on a bunch of people who are right around him, there's no way that President Obama or we could actually trust what he's saying.
Well, I mean, the different kinds of interests come into play there, but certainly I agree, Aaron. He plays his cards close to the chest. August Cole, Susan Shirk says, if he wanted to stop this, he could. Is that right?
I think that's a lot harder said than done. You know, Xi has a position as the head of the Central Military Commission, mm-hmm. a very important role as president as well, mm-hmm. because it gives him authority over the army. But much of the hacking is also carried out by quasi-governmental groups. And if those are aligned with the billionaires who are driving many of these companies forward and want to press on with this, they'll press on with it.
John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, you're on. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about President Xi Jinping's possible aggressiveness or, ability to handle risk. But, you know, I wonder if there's not a different way to look at this, which mm-hmm. is the overall arc of Chinese growth and influence. And that there, I think I'm under the impression that there's a kind of a plan in China for, you know, as power and influence grows, their behavior is going to change because they can handle more. And so it may be less about the current president than the overall arc of Chinese growth.
Their behavior is going to change in what direction? What do you mean, John?
Well, I think that, you know, with regards to how they deal with the U.S. and how they deal with the surrounding Asian countries, you know, they have to play nice as long as we're clearly stronger militarily. But generally speaking, they don't anymore once they've acquired enough of our intelligence to make some of the same stuff that we have, et cetera. And I think we're starting to see the early period of that. And so I think this may be less president-specific and more, you know, Chinese growth-specific.
Damien Ma, what do you make of that? That there's an agenda that's waiting behind the economic growth to assert itself, more power projection by China? I mean, Xi Jinping says very explicitly at length, big interview with the Wall Street Journal, look, we don't want to turn over the international order. We're part of it. We benefit from it. But there's the talk about the Chinese dream, and he's very clear that China suffered under what many Chinese see as foreign oppression for most of a century until not so long ago. What do you see coming, Damien?
Well, I don't know if there's a secret hidden agenda, but I do think it's absolutely true that China has always wanted to be treated as an equal great power at the global arena. I think there is certainly some truth to the fact that, you know, your behavior as a country changes when your capabilities increase. And it's pretty clear that the Chinese capabilities economically and militarily have changed. So obviously their behavior and perhaps their intentions will evolve accordingly. I think part a secondary reason, I think there's also been a little bit of frustration with the slow adaptation of global governance institutions. As we all know, there's been much discussion of China rolling out the Asian Infrastructure Bank.
Yes.
That was a bit contentious issue. But I think part of that was a result of, you know, frustration with lack of reforms at the IMF, you know, and also obviously, you know, we have the G20 now, which is a very good step forward. But I think there is a way to make perhaps that governance institution more credible, more adaptable to 21st century realities. And so I think there's a variety of reasons, but I do think there is certainly some truth. I mean, like any country, like the United States in its heyday, when its capabilities grow, its behavior changes.
I mean, Susan, it's interesting. Talking to the Wall Street Journal, Xi Jinping rolled out Mencius, the classical Chinese philosopher, and I don't have it in front of me, but essentially saying, look, things change. And when they change, the world has to change also. I don't know if that's a bid for supremacy, but you know, you could look at this as him just saying, look, the facts of the world are changing and we can't just stay stuck in the way things were, USA.
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, Mencius is my favorite.
ahead of Confucius for you, huh?
Okay. Yeah. And, of course, it's interesting that he uses these symbols and ideas back in Confucianism, which was totally destroyed by the communists in the Mao era.
Yeah.
And now they're trying to revive it again. But, you know, I think that it's really a challenge for the United States to think about how to respond to a China which is stronger. Although the growth rates, as they decline, it's not going to be quite as economically strong in size as quickly as we once thought it might be.
What about this great power relationship with the USA? Want to be seen as a great power, which has been kind of the way of saying seen as an equal. Xi Jinping has talked about this for some years now, even before he became president. And the implication, the interpretation of that has been that if the U.S. sees us as an equal, they won't complain about certain things that we see as settled, like Tibet, like the South China Sea.
Yes, the so-called core interests. And, you know, that's why President Obama has not been willing to utter the words exactly the way the Chinese would like us to utter them about a new type of great power relationship. But the objective is shared. The objective of managing China's rise and the fact that here in the United States, we don't want to be the only country responsible for maintaining world peace and order. We do want other countries to take on those responsibilities and work with us. The United States needs mm-hmm. other countries, you know, our friends and allies, but even new kind of newcomer countries like China to work with us. And if we can figure out a way to do that, it's all to the good for everyone.
Michael in Atlanta, Georgia. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was curious if we really have any benefit from focusing the conversation on China's hacking capabilities and not focusing more of the conversation on economic terms, in so much that any person who has access to a computer in the world has the capability to do exactly what China's doing. Granted, they're state-sponsored, but why are we focusing so much on that and not focusing really on the greater economic conversation?
Well, but Michael, isn't hacking an economic issue? If you can hack in and take intellectual property, the next thing you know, you're producing what used to be American technology. Isn't that economic?
It is and it isn't. As a security practitioner, I see people from all over the globe doing this exact same thing on a daily basis. And it's not just China that's involved. The conversation for us specifically mm-hmm. should be focused more on defensive capabilities than offense.
Michael, I appreciate your call. August Cole, thinking about hacking is the wrong place to focus. What do you think?
I think it is a good place to focus, actually, because it's a symptom of a larger relationship we have with China. And China is using the way they are employing cybersecurity as a means towards this larger sense of their destiny in the Pacific, if not the globe. You know, the Chinese
employing
dream is
cybersecurity.
Real.
You mean that offensive
cyber operations? Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely offensive. And offense is in many ways easier than defense, as we found in the U.S.
But our Atlantic caller says everybody does it. Come on.
That's true. And we are practitioners of some of the best cyber offense capabilities in the world.
Do we exercise those? Are we out stealing intellectual property too?
Not at the commercial level in the same way as the Chinese. At the
is
military
the government,
level.
Is the CIA doing it and handing it off to Honeywell?
No, not that we know of. But
that's what's going on in China, isn't it?
Correct. So what I think is interesting is that the Snowden revelations came just before Xi's visit to California, and it changed the cyber conversation. And we're again having another state-level visit like this driven by a cyber conversation within a much bigger economic and strategic picture. And so I think it's important to take that higher-level view about U.S. strategy with China in the Pacific, in the world, and also remember there's another administration coming soon. And this Obama's clock is running out to try to address
this. Republicans have been talking very tough here. Donald Trump said cancel the visit, give him a McDonald's hamburger.
So President Xi Jinping has a short window of time to put things on his terms for the next administration. I think that's a big part of this visit too.
Damian Ma, do you think that by the time these few handful of days are over, we'll have some kind of good handshake moment here with the two leaders, Obama and Xi?
Well, I think it's certainly possible. If you're referring specifically to the cyber issue, I think it's pretty clear that the Chinese did get the message. If you recall, a few weeks ago, President Xi dispatched his security minister, Meng Jiandru, to have closed-door meetings with the White House in D.C. So it's possible. Again, I have no idea what will actually come out of it. But I do think that a broader point that everyone has raised, I think this is this issue, it's also not necessarily just a bilateral issue. It's also a multilateral issue. It should be a global issue. So I think there's a lot of things to do to kind of get us there.
Xi Jinping in Seattle today and headed east, ultimately to Washington, and then on to the UN. He'll address a big General Assembly meeting there. Damian Ma at the University of Chicago Paulson Institute, author of In Line Behind a Billion People, How Scarcity Will Define China's Ascent in the Next Decade. That's interesting. Damian, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
August Cole, co-author of Ghost Fleet, a novel of the next world war. Thank you so much for coming in, August.
Thank you.
And Susan Shirk at the University of California, San Diego, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. Susan, it's always great to have you with us.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.